Well, we're obviously very disappointed. We thought we had a pretty good argument, but they saw it differently, apparently.
The U.S. Supreme Court rules against the city of Valdez. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 15th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Juneau confronts an extensive drug problem among teens.
It's been the drug of choice here in Juneau for the last 3 years, and it far exceeds the problems that we've seen with other drugs.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
A three-judge panel of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that plaintiffs in the Exxon Valdez oil spill litigation should receive 5.9% interest on their punitive damages dating back to September 1996. Matt Jamin is an attorney with the Kodiak firm that represents plaintiffs in the case. Last year, after the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision to cap punitive damages at $507.5 million. Jamin says the high court asked the Ninth Circuit to rule on the issue of how far back Exxon should have to pay interest. The court panel heard oral arguments from Exxon and plaintiffs late last year and issued its decision today,
concluding that plaintiffs are in fact entitled to interest back to the date in September 1996 when the district court originally entered the judgment, rather than on the date that the Supreme Court reduced the judgment in June 2008, which was Exxon's argument.
If the ruling stands, the total interest awarded to the thousands of fishermen, processing workers, and Alaska Natives who are plaintiffs in the lawsuit would total about $500 million. Jamin says it's a victory for those who were stung by the Supreme Court's decision to set punitive damages at one-tenth of the original jury award, but Exxon has the opportunity to appeal.
I mean, Exxon can certainly ask the circuit court, the Ninth Circuit, to review their decision. They can ask the three judges who heard it to review it. They can also ask that a larger panel be appointed by the court to hear it, something that's called en banc consideration. They could also not do that and simply ask the United States Supreme Court to hear the case.
Exxon has 2 weeks from today's ruling to ask for the Ninth Circuit Court to review the case. If the company lets the 2 weeks go by without doing that, it would then have 90 days to ask the Supreme Court for review. U.S. Supreme Court justices ruled against the port community of Valdez today in a case that has consequences for the city's revenue base. APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline ends at Valdez Arm, a narrow, protected fjord jutting inland from Prince William Sound that is busy with commercial fishing boats and giant oil tankers. The port of Valdez is located there, and under a 1999 ordinance, the city of Valdez imposed a property tax on any ship 95 feet long or more that uses its port. That length restriction limited the city tax pretty much to oil tankers, which load at the pipeline terminal. Polar Tankers, Inc., a subsidiary of ConocoPhillips, objected and sued. Although Alaska Superior Court declared Valdez's tax unconstitutional in 2004, the Alaska Supreme Court upheld it. The case made its way to the United States Supreme Court, and today, the High Court justices decided that the Valdez tax violates the tonnage clause of the United States Constitution, which prohibits states from charging ships entering or using their ports without the consent of Congress.
We've always believed that that tax unfairly targeted our industry.
Bill Stevens is a ConocoPhillips spokesman.
We've consistently argued that the Valdez tanker tax targets vessels for discriminatory tax treatment, and therefore it's unconstitutional. We're fortunate that seven justices agreed with us.
The Supreme Court justices ruled in favor of Polar Tankers 7-2. Valdez City Manager John Hosey says the city has not digested the ruling yet.
Well, we're obviously very disappointed. We prevailed at the Alaska Supreme Court on this, and we thought we had a pretty good argument with the U.S. Supreme Court, but they saw it differently, apparently.
Valdez gains about 11% of its annual revenue from the tanker tax. No word yet on whether the city will be required to reimburse Polar Tankers.
There's potential interest charges or other fees that we may need to consider. And then we also need to consider, you know, what options we have regarding having to pay those back. So, again, we've only had this information a few hours ourselves, and we are still trying to digest it.
Attorney Charles Rothfeld, who represents Polar Tankers in the case, argued that the tax discriminates against oil tankers because fishing boats were not included in the levy. He also stated that the tankers pay a disproportionate amount in property tax when compared with Valdez homeowners. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The head of a U.S. Senate oversight panel looking into the small business contracts awarded to Alaska Native corporations says her office is still working on collecting information in advance of next month's hearing. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill chairs a subcommittee on contracting oversight. She's called for a hearing July 16th to look into the advantages given to Alaska Native corporations under the Small Business Administration's 8A program. McCaskill initially gave 20 Alaska Native corporations about 2 weeks to turn over financial information about their revenue, dividend payouts, and business relationships. Some of the companies and Alaska's congressional delegation asked for more time, and McCaskill says that's been no problem.
We've tried to be flexible, and most of them have been very cooperative and helpful, and I think we're going to get all we need in time for the hearing.
Alaska's congressional delegation also asked that representatives from the Native corporations be invited to testify at the July hearing. McCaskill says her committee will invite some of the corporations.
The goal here is to get at this particular contracting practice and see if there's a good reason for it. I mean, the goal of it was to establish credibility and viability for these Native corporations to participate in federal contracting. I'm not sure that that same goal is now being accomplished. I think it may have morphed into something else, and that's what we want to get to the bottom of.
Alaska Native corporations do gain advantages under the 8A program, which is intended to give a leg up to disadvantaged minority-owned and small businesses. The executive director for the Native American Contractors Association, Sarah Lukin, says that's the whole point.
Alaska Native corporations, like tribes and Native Hawaiian organizations, represent entire communities of disadvantaged Alaska Native people and are responsible for providing economic, cultural, and social benefits to them in perpetuity.
But while other 8A firms have a limit on the size of the contract they can go after or a time frame in which they can qualify for the program, the Native corporations don't have such restrictions. They can win sole source contracts of any value. Lukin says there's also a valid reason for that.
So if you look at an Alaska Native corporation, which will represent hundreds and oftentimes thousands of disadvantaged individuals, and you compare that to, you know, another 8A business that represents a single family, you can see why an Alaska Native corporation would be afforded additional benefits, because frankly, they have to serve more people.
Senator McCaskill says she also has concerns that much of the work is done outside Alaska and specifically points to Virginia as a center of activity. But Lukin says there are no restrictions on where the corporations can operate.
As many know, Alaska Native corporations are headquartered here in the state. But like all government contractors, we have the opportunity and the right to work anywhere that our customer may need us.
Lukin says Alaska Native corporations are represented in all 50 states, a number of foreign countries, and employ over 30,000 people worldwide. She says the corporations are willing to work with the investigating committee. Senator McCaskill says she hopes the hearing gets a handle on where work is being performed and what rationale there is for non-competitiveness. McCaskill says her sense is that there may not be a good reason for it.
I think we've got to look at it and see if, in fact, they deserve this kind of carve-out from the rules that apply to everyone else. I have nothing against Alaska Native corporations. I just am here to make sure that the taxpayers are getting full value for every dollar. And you know, I think the people of Alaska would appreciate that.
The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee on Contracting Oversight will meet on July 16th to look into the contracts. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Emonik residents struggle to clean up flood damage.
It's pretty dangerous living in here. In fact, very dangerous. I shouldn't even be living here, but then I got no other place to go to.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848.
A number of wildfires are burning in southwestern Alaska, but firefighting crews appear to have the upper hand on a couple of them. State Forestry Division spokesman Andy Alexandro in McGrath says lightning sparked several fires.
Over the weekend, Friday and Saturday in particular, we picked up five new fires. One was not staffed because of its location and the limited fire management option attached to it.
The rest of the new fires are east and northeast of Aniak. Meanwhile, firefighters have completed a fire break to protect the village of Talida from the still-burning Tonklanuka fire, which has consumed 38,000 acres.
They did one heck of a burnout along the east and north and south of the village, which very much made the possibility of fire not reaching the buildings in the village much greater. So the community of three people there are in pretty good shape.
They plan to demobilize from that fire soon. There are 43 firefighters on the Holokuk fire east of Aniak, which has burned about 200 acres. There's also a fire burning in the Galena district. It's called the Yellow River Fire, and 40 people are fighting it. Smoke jumpers also responded to a fire on the west side of the Alaska Range in the Farewell Burn. That fire was started months ago by a campfire set by Iditarod mushers.
Detected back in March and then in April, and fire wasn't really harming anything. It went to 109 acres, but it did jump the Post River. Land manager wanted the fire not to go to the north of the Post River, so in recent days we've had 13 smoke jumpers up there just putting the fire out.
More thunderstorms are in the forecast for the area. For the third year, OxyContin remains the illegal drug of choice among Juneau teens. That's one reason the Juneau School Board is putting a mandatory random student drug testing program up for public hearing and possible action this August. A committee is already working on a proposal. The active ingredient in OxyContin is oxycodone, a powerful narcotic with an addiction potential similar to that of morphine. While drugs like Percodan or Tylox contain 5 milligrams of oxycodone, OxyContin can contain 30 times as much. And as KTOO's Rebecca Shear reports, that can make for one hard habit to break.
Officially, it's known as OxyContin, a semi-synthetic member of the opiate family, prescribed for chronic or long-lasting pain. But on the street...
Oh, there's OC, Oxy, Fluff, Cotton, a lot of different things, yeah.
However, says Matt Felix, director of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, or NCAD, whatever you call OxyContin.
It's extremely strong. It's very, very addicting. And for someone who is immature, teenage years, their nervous system hasn't developed to the level of resistance that adults have. This is a very, very dangerous drug.
And an increasingly widespread one, too. Connecticut-based pharmaceutical company Purdue Pharma brought OxyContin to market in 1996. By 2008, the timed-release analgesic was one of the most frequently abused prescription drugs among teenagers. In a National Institute of Drug Abuse survey from that year, 4.7% of high school seniors reported non-medical use of OxyContin. Matt Felix isn't sure what that percentage would be in Juneau, but he's certain the number is rising.
We have these waves of drugs that come through. This one is unusual that it's long-lasting. It's been the drug of choice here in Juneau for the last 3 years, and it far exceeds the problems that we've seen with other drugs.
Felix says the number of Oxy-related crisis calls to NCAD has doubled every year since 2006.
And it's been not just kids, but adults as well. I had a woman the other day who has a legal reason for using it. She's been in a car accident, had a broken back, although that's been 4 years ago. She's still getting a 30-day supply at a time. She breaks them in half, sells half, and uses the other half for her pain.
And according to Felix, she makes a pretty nice living. An 80-milligram tablet costs approximately $6 by prescription. But Felix estimates the street price at anywhere from $140 to $180. The Juneau Police Department says it can go as high as $250.
I have a friend, actually, that does it a lot, and that's why he wanted to get a job this summer. That's pretty much the only reason he wanted to.
To support his habit.
Yeah.
This Juneau High School student, we'll call him Andy since we were asked not to use his real name, says he knows many kids who abuse Oxy.
Too many.
Too many?
Yeah.
They break it into rocks, he says, and smoke it for a more instant high. And some of those kids resort to far more illicit means than a summer job to support their habit. Like the varsity soccer player who was arrested a few years back for stealing Oxy from a Mendenhall Valley home. But Andy says he's most concerned about this one friend of his because...
The sad thing is he's very, very smart. Gets like straight A's. I don't know how. And he plays sports, but he's not going to go anywhere with if he keeps doing that.
Andy has confronted his friend's parents, but they refuse to believe their son is on drugs. And that's the thing with Oxy. It can be tough to tell someone's on it. For instance, unlike marijuana or alcohol, two other prevalent substances among Juneau's youth, Oxy doesn't have a smell. Though there are other indicators. Users often become lethargic, and the pupils of their eyes shrink to pinpoints.
Your pupils get smaller, like really, really small, and I could tell. And he's not very nice or anything if he's not on it.
What was he like before?
He was fun to hang around, liked to do anything. Now he just doesn't really do much, except go around trying to find a drug.
Andy admits he tried Oxy once, but got violently ill. Now, not only has he sworn off the drug, but once he graduates, he's swearing off Juneau, too.
I want to definitely get out of here. I just want to go to a better place and get away from all the drugs. Because, like, a couple of my friends who went to treatment, they come back, and kids just automatically ask them if they want to do drugs, and they get back into it.
And that, says NCAD's Matt Felix, is the most dangerous part.
It's a short gestation period from use to addiction. So it's a very, very hard drug to become clean with.
There are counter drugs out there, injectable treatments that curb the so-called euphoria sought by Oxy users. But Oxy addiction is considered a chronic condition, Felix says, a disorder even.
So once you become addicted to this drug, you have to be very careful the rest of your life.
That is, he says, assuming you get that long. In 2005, the last year for which governmental data are available, more than 8,500 people died from overdosing on prescription drugs such as OxyContin. That's double the number from 2001. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP. Teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. And by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
The state's largest satellite receiving facility is getting a new operations center. $9 million in federal economic stimulus money will help fund construction of the new building at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Data Recovery Station north of Fairbanks. Center manager Lance Seaman says the new structure will replace a facility built by NASA in the early days of the satellite era.
Since this building was built to be about a 20, 30-year building, and here we're in it, 45 years later, it was time to replace it. And NOAA realizing the importance of environmental monitoring. They definitely chose to keep this site long term and keep us operating for at least another 20 years.
The 20,000-square-foot center will house computers and other equipment used to download images and other data from satellites. The facility is hidden from view on an 85-acre, 100-acre site off the Steese Highway. Seaman says the station provides the primary downlink for 20 satellites.
We take in real-time data, imagery over Alaska, and also they play back their recorders, just like a tape recorder, of other parts of the Earth. Other side of the globe, any place that scientists need or request NOAA to image. And so therefore, we are a very busy tracking station, one of the most busiest in the world. This year, we're projected to take 56,000 satellite passes.
The Fairbanks station is also used to gather images of wildfires and predict weather in space, like solar storms. The station's 57 employees support a 24/7 operation charged with maintaining automated tracking systems. The Fairbanks Satellite Receiving Station building replacement is the first NOAA project supported by economic stimulus funds. Residents on the Lower Yukon are working through the damages left by the spring breakup. Many residents in the coastal community of Imonik have no fish racks and smokehouses left after the flood. They're also busy assessing the damages to their homes, dozens of which were affected by high water. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Alice Criswell reports.
This wasn't the first year that Stan Jimmy's home was damaged by spring flooding. But the 61-year-old Imonik resident thinks this breakup might have finally ruined his home. An inch of water covered the floor, ruining all his insulation and the foundation.
It's pretty dangerous living in here. In fact, very dangerous. I shouldn't even be living here, but then I got no other place to go to. So I'm afraid if I don't get an emergency housing or something, I might have to live out in a tent this winter.
Jimmy says his home is supported inside by 2x4s and poles, and it's sagging. He's supporting the outside walls with logs to keep it from collapsing. He says he has also been living with bugs in his home, even on his bed.
You can't imagine how much bugs there is in here. I don't know what's with these people here in Imonik. They see my house every day, pass by my house every day, and yet they don't want to do nothing. You know, I'm beginning to give up.
The city knows that Jimmy's house is not livable the way it is, but they are waiting on funding to come in before they can really do much about it. According to Martin Moore, Imonik City Administrator, some 72 homes in the community have been severely damaged by the floodwaters. Most of it was floor and insulation damage and damage to foundations. Some homes ended up with 3 inches of muck left on the floors as residue. Moore says the state authorized some cleaning disinfectant, and residents have done their best to clean up the debris. But the city estimates damages are in the millions of dollars. That is not counting damages to other property, like fish camps, many of which were totaled.
The ice knocked down the fish racks and took the nets and took everything that they had in fish camps. So before they even start to cut fish, they have to rebuild their fish racks, their smokehouses.
Also damaged were snow machines and four-wheelers. Moore says people stored them on higher ground, but the heavy current destroyed the foundations anyway, leaving the machines submerged in water. Moore says most of the people don't have the money to buy new lumber and sheet iron to rebuild their homes and other property immediately.
The homeowners have been asking questions. When will the representatives of the federal government and the state government come and assess our damages?
President Obama authorized a disaster for the region last week, and the state declared a disaster this spring while the flood was happening. But Moore says they haven't gotten direct responses from either government on whether or not the severely damaged homes will be replaced. Another Imonik resident, Jim McGuffey's home, was damaged by water getting into the insulation. His home was built by the BIA just 3 years ago. Luckily, the water only came up to the edge of their porch and didn't get inside, but the bottom of the home is ruined. As for getting help from anyone, McGuffey, says he's not expecting much.
The only thing I have heard is that FEMA maybe will give $5,000 per household. It's really it's kind of a laugh. Just $5,000, just barely even covers getting the material out, most less buying it. So I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do.
The breakup flood is just one of several hardships that have hit Demonic this year. This winter, heating oil prices fluctuated between $8 and $11 a gallon, and some residents were forced to decide between heating their homes or buying groceries. This summer's Yukon King Run is predicted to be one of the worst on record, and fishery regulators have restricted subsistence fishing to 2 18-hour periods per week on the river. It's enough to make some people want to move. McGuffey and his family have lived in Emonic for 15 years, and he says they will stay there until they can find some other place to live. In Bethel, I'm Alice Criswell.
Diving crews cut efforts short over the weekend while recovering diesel fuel from the sunken supply boat Monarch. The operation in Cook Inlet began Saturday, and the state on-scene coordinator from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, Gary Fawley, says the tides affected the ship used as a staging area.
The mooring system failed, I think it was about 8 o'clock that evening. And so at this point, what the engineers and the salvage master are doing are doing some engineering studies to see if they can come up with a stronger mooring system. And also, it may be that the deep draft of the Perseverance is working against us, making it more susceptible to the currents.
By that time, the divers had recovered about 1,000 gallons of fuel. They estimate a total of about 30,000 gallons. Fawley says the little time they had Saturday meant they at least know the suction system works. Now, he says, they need to implement a new plan.
At this point, we're out looking for a replacement vessel, something that would be more suitable as a dive platform, and also reevaluating the mooring system.
The Monarch sank in January while delivering supplies to a drilling platform about 16 miles west of Nikiski. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Rebecca Shear in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alice Criswell in Bethel, and Ben Stanton in Kenai. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by GrantStation, now offering several webinars each month. More information at GrantStation.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.